Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us today, May 11th, 2020, for the National Creditors Bar Association's live briefing call entitled Breaking News, District Court Restrains Enforcement of Massachusetts AG Emergency Regulations. I'm Nathan Wilner, Government Affairs Officer here at NCBA, and I'd like to welcome all of you to today's event. Joining us today are Moshe Broder and Dwayne Paza with the nationally recognized DC law firm Wiley. Moshe Broder counsels and represents government contractors and subcontractors on a broad range of legal issues, including bid protests and contract claims and disputes. Moshe regularly prosecutes and defends bid protests before the U.S. Government Accountability Office and the U.S. Court of Federal Claims and litigates commercial disputes in state and federal courts. Dwayne Paza advises clients on complex legal and regulatory issues involving emerging technology, consumer protection, and Federal Trade Commission enforcement. He counsels on a range of issues, including privacy and data governance, advertising law, competition matters, and consumer financial laws and regulations. He represents clients before the FTC and has a broad experience dealing with all levels of the agency. So welcome to Moshe and Dwayne today, and thank you for taking the time to join us on this briefing call regarding this very interesting case that industry has been watching closely. So I'm just going to kick it off with a question and turn it over to both of you to kind of take us through this. So the judge in this case entered a TRO and a preliminary injunction in the ACA International versus Healy case. So what happened in this case and how did we get here?
Great, and good question. Thanks a lot for having us. We appreciate the opportunity to talk about this very interesting case today and its implications. So I'll kick off, and Moshe and I are going to go through sort of the background of the case. It deals with a Massachusetts Emergency Debt Collection Regulation 940 CMR 35, which is called the Unfair and Deceptive Debt Collection Practices During the State of Emergency Caused by COVID-19. So it comes directly out of the COVID-19 pandemic. It was passed on March 26. It was issued on March 26, 2020. It was issued pursuant to the Massachusetts statute that prohibits unfair or deceptive acts or practices. So it's UDAP statute. And among other things, it prohibits certain debt collectors, or it would have until it was struck down, prohibited certain debt collectors from initiating telephone calls to debtors and from initiating or threatening to initiate a lawsuit to collect the debt or act upon a remedy already obtained. The duration of these prohibitions under the regulation was 90 days. Or until the state of emergency expires, whichever occurred first. The Attorney General actually, in defending the law, said that the regulation could be extended if the emergency continues. So even though by its terms it's 90 days, there's the chance that were it to go into effect, continue to go into effect with the extended. The regulation had certain exceptions that ended up being pretty important in the legal analysis. Collecting mortgage debts was carved out, tenant debts, utility debts, certain nonprofit entities, federal employees, and those serving legal process, those were exempt as well. So the ACA filed suit on April 20th in the United States District Court for the District of Massachusetts, and then sought declaratory and injunctive relief, a TRO, and a preliminary injunction. So I'll turn it over now to Moshe to describe the arguments around that and the resolution.
Thanks, Dwayne, and thanks, Nathan, again, for having us. It's really a privilege to be here today to talk to you about this case. So I'll just talk briefly about the arguments that were raised in the litigation that kind of led to the court's decision here. So ACA raised several constitutional claims under the First Amendment, the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, and also alleged that it was denied equal protection of the laws. In addition to these constitutional claims, ACA asserted a number of statutory and state law claims, including violation of the Massachusetts anti-SLAPP statute, infringement of the Massachusetts common law litigation privilege, and an unlawful expansion of the AG's regulatory authority. ACA argued that the law inhibited productive communication with debtors, including providing advice on potential assistance options for distressed individuals. Members with Massachusetts operations, ACA argued, saw a decline in receipts between 20% and 70%. And some have already been forced to lay off employees and others face the prospect of going out of business. And the ACA argued that this was really a central piece of the harm that was caused to it by these regulations. And it's particularly relevant to attorneys. ACA argued that the regulation encroached on the First Amendment right to petition the government for a redress of grievances by imposing a moratorium on imposition of debt collection lawsuits. Indeed, the regulation that was imposed would appear to have applied both in federal courts as well as courts of other states besides from Massachusetts. The Massachusetts AG raised a number of arguments, and we won't discuss all of them here, but at a high level, the AG emphasized that huge unemployment numbers in the Commonwealth, as well as other challenges associated with responding to the pandemic, made the regulation necessary. It also argued that the rules were only temporary and therefore they didn't interfere with any substantive right. And it's also important to note that with regards to the First Amendment right to petition the government, which we just discussed, Massachusetts argued that ACA would not prevail on the merits because the mandated delay was only temporary. It would only last 90 days at most. And so the AG argued that because the prohibition was, you know, purportedly temporary, the regulation was procedural and therefore did not irrevocably prevent creditors from vindicating any substantive right. So now turning to the court's opinion in the case. So as many of you know, the court granted the TRO and PI, and we'll walk through the court's analysis and reasoning there and highlight some relevant considerations. First, the court considered four factors under the well-established standard on a motion for TRO or PI, which are, first, the likelihood of success in the merits, second, the likelihood of suffering irreparable harm in the absence of preliminary relief, third, a balancing of the equities between the parties, and fourth, the public interest in the case. And as with most First Amendment cases, the vast majority of the opinion focused on the likelihood of success on the merits. And Duane, I'll turn it over to you for a discussion there.
Great, thanks. So the First Amendment analysis on each of the central issues here regarding the ban on calls and then the ban on initiating suits was very strong. But the first threshold question that the court had to analyze was what level of scrutiny to give this under the First Amendment. So in analyzing the likelihood of success on the merit, the court considered ACA's argument that this should be subject to the highest form of scrutiny, strict scrutiny, meaning that it's going to be sort of, you know, presumptively struck down, but instead decided to apply the level called intermediate scrutiny that applies to commercial speech. That comes out of a Supreme Court decision called Central Hudson that sort of created the commercial speech doctrine, and that's what ultimately followed there. So that gives states, and we'll talk about this more leeway to craft regulations concerning collection communications if they do it in a way that's proper. So the court first found that the speech was protected by the First Amendment under the Central Hudson test. It examined three factors: whether the asserted government interest was substantial, whether the regulation advanced that interest, and whether the regulation was overbroad or more extensive than necessary to serve that interest. Under the asserted government interest, the court expressed some skepticism about various explanations of the government interest. It ultimately did decide that for purposes of analysis, that there is an interest that the state has in what it called preserving domestic tranquility. It refers to this as a residential privacy interest. And this is the idea that I think is behind a lot of different kinds of prohibitions on making certain numbers of telephone calls and that. It's a residential privacy interest. The court found that the regulation incrementally decreased the number of calls that someone would get because it did ban some calls, but it was skeptical about the impact of the regulation. It talked about how a person can simply put their phone on vibrate mode or use caller ID to screen out unwanted calls. And also critically, it noted that it didn't stop collection efforts as other categories of debt collectors were exempted from the regulation. So because consumers could still get calls from other people, it wasn't really advancing the goal to the extent that it, you know, was a good goal in protecting their, quote, residential privacy. So it also talked about how there are already existing laws, the FTC Act, the FDCPA, that already protect consumers from abusive, deceptive, and unfair debt collection practices. So ultimately, it found that there was not a good fit between what the statute was trying to, what the regulation was trying to accomplish and its purported goals, and thus did not survive First Amendment scrutiny. On the portion of it that that banned petitioning the government or filing lawsuits, the court was also very skeptical about infringing on the First Amendment rights of ACA members to petition the government by filing suit. As we discussed previously, the AG had argued that because the regulation only imposed a 90-day delay on these filings, it was just a procedural obstacle to eventually allowing people to go into court and seek to collect on the debt. But one of the reasons why this was rejected is because the AG conceded that the 90 days could be extended. And it also, I think, very strongly rejected the idea that that was just a procedural barrier to it. Instead, it was a violating a core First Amendment principle of the ability of a party to go to court in order to vindicate its rights. The balance of the equities and the public interest were dispensed of in a single paragraph, but I think is also very helpful. The court was very specifically cited the issues with small debt collection agencies being put out of business and the burden that this would have on businesses in the industry, and weighed that against what it found to be any minimal benefit, particularly given the existing law, to any consumers. And it also noted that it recognized ACA's argument that, you know, there is a vested interest in the efficient functioning of the credit market, which depends on the ability to collect debts. And also footnoted that, in fact, Massachusetts had declared collection agencies essential businesses. So there was a recognition that there's another side, and it's not just about the interest of vindicating consumers, but also the impact it would have on the industry side as well.
So, okay, so you took us through how we got here. So by far, this case is not over. What are we likely going to see in the next steps in this litigation?
Sure. So, well, at the outset, we would note that the state can consider whether to appeal the order and seek a stay of the order. Although the emergency nature of the regulation makes this a little tricky, as well as the slow pace of the appellate process, you can imagine that the time to brief the case and to argue it and then to get a decision from the appellate court could take quite a while, and hopefully by the time, you know, the time that would pass, we could all be looking back at this as something of the past. So an appeal would be a little tricky at this point, but it's certainly a possibility. If it went into litigation and proceeded further, there could be discovery, and that discovery could include discovery around the collection practices in Massachusetts in particular, as well as other issues that was raised in the briefing. And finally, I expect that if this proceeded to litigation, there would be further motions practice, as well as potentially dispositive a briefing on summary judgment. This does not seem like the kind of case that would go to trial, although, you know, anything is possible again.
Okay, so a lot happened. A lot still could happen. So, you know, what could our members see as impact of this case on other state emergency or regulatory orders, you know, which are trying to limit debt collection activities or additional state laws? Like, what does this say to that?
Well, I think this is a pretty compelling decision. It's coming out of a respected court, and it's well-reasoned. So I think there are a few different takeaways when thinking about other potential state emergency regulatory orders or laws that might come out. The first is, one thing that's, I think, relevant, particularly to something that comes out of the pandemic, is, you know, the court has a line in there where it quotes the Supreme Court's holding that the mere fact of an emergency does not increase constitutional power, nor diminish constitutional restrictions. So I think it's important to realize in this case, and I think you've seen it in other sorts of litigation, that courts are able to take a step back, realize that the pandemic is causing a lot of changes in the way the world is working and causing a lot of financial hardship, but still be able to analyze how far governments can go without overly expanding their power. And particularly when you're looking at something like the First Amendment, I think governments are very solicitous of that. And the rhetoric in this decision would be useful to the extent another state passed a similar sort of restriction. I also think that the holding against the restriction on the initiation of lawsuits is also on strong grounds and would be useful in other states. Some of the restrictions and reasoning around restricting the calls, for example, gets tricky in states. We could talk about this. States might be able to craft better sort of reasoned regulations that would survive scrutiny But I do think it's a very powerful argument for any against any kind of regulation that would attempt to shut down the filing of suits. So so it's very helpful. The court rejected a number of blanket justifications that Massachusetts had. Massachusetts had, as we discussed, this idea that they're protecting the privacy of the home, and the court analyzed that. But Massachusetts also said, well, we need to stop, quote, aggressive practices that they thought would have, quote, undue influence on consumers in the pandemic. They also had a general interest in protecting consumer financial well-being. And the court actually said, well, benefit those interests are, they're not served by this law. That there's no evidence that there's any undue influence being exerted here, and certainly no evidence that there needs to be an extension of the existing set of laws around debt collection practices to ban additional speech on top of all the protections that currently exist. So that was also, I think, very helpful. The flip side of that is Massachusetts did this very quick. There was essentially a 24-hour turnaround or something, and that was even under dispute. And it was really not a ban that was tailored to circumstances that they really had a good evidentiary record to support. Now, if this was not something that was an emergency declaration, as Moshe was talking about, where in 90 days it might be moot, you would, I think, eventually possibly go to some evidentiary hearings or other sorts of proceedings to figure out what evidence underlies the different distinctions that Massachusetts drew. But the court was pretty skeptical that they're a bit haphazard. They weren't really backed up by an idea that we're targeting this kind of conduct because it's certain conduct and not us just stopping speech, stopping these calls or stopping the ability to initiate a lawsuit. You could see another state having more targeted restrictions. And this is where the First Amendment analysis under the Central Hudson prong comes in. Because it's not given the strictest of scrutiny, because there is this test that looks at how closely does the regulation serve its interest and are there less restrictive means, for something like the privacy of the home or possibly some of these other justifications, I think a more clever state could craft or try to craft a regulation that more specifically targeted at it. It's still the First Amendment interest involved, and I think there are good arguments against those, but those arguments wouldn't just be rejected out of hand. So the last thing I would say is an interesting part of this, and it could be something that could be an issue in other cases if states also come up with other sorts of emergency regulations, is there were actually a bunch of state law claims in this case, as Moshe brought up, about Massachusetts exceeding its authority under its own state law. And those got thrown out by the court, actually. The federal court, under long-standing ex parte Young doctrine, said the federal court doesn't have the ability to rule on these state court causes of action against the state. So that means that in other circumstances, some of those very state-specific arguments, the ones that aren't just about the First Amendment, would have to be brought in state court, which is an entirely different ball of wax, and I think might have a different approach depending on the state.
So, well, thank you for that. That was very insightful and went through it in a really organized way. So then the question comes, could this decision have a long-term effect on future state legislation? In other words, after this is over, are we going to have to worry about this case having impact on what we see throughout the country on legislative issues in state state houses?
Yeah, good question. I think the fact that it came out the way it did is always helpful. It had come out the opposite way in this case. We'd be looking at a much different landscape in terms of what states might be emboldened to do. I do think if you're looking at sort of any legislative fixes and not just these emergency orders, I do think it shows that speech restrictions that are not tied to a unique policy justification are particularly vulnerable. So there are certainly many different reasons that folks, all sorts of stakeholders might have in treating the kind of debt differently. And, obviously there are distinctions in the laws about how you, certain collection processes. I do think that they have to be tied to some sort of evidentiary record. And one thing that was going on here was that it was such an emergency that it just exempted a bunch of debt collectors and exempted a bunch of individuals. and didn't really explain why. And that's not going to be looked at closely. But if you're talking about a legislative process, you could see more evidence being developed. The second piece of this is, if states wanted to, I think they could try to be more clever about putting up additional barriers to filing of collection lawsuits under an argument that it's a procedural limitation. I mean, that argument was really shot down in this case, but this is really egregious, and that would be another sort of battlefield if states were looking to sort of modify their laws. And then the last point that sort of overlays this, I think, is even without a change in laws, I do think that you would see in any event states just sort of interpreting their laws more strictly and ramping up enforcement. And I also just think generally in a economic down cycle, you'd likely to see that reaction from states as well as on the federal level, and just sort of shoehorn practices into the framework of their existing laws.
So we talked about the state level. So my question is, I'm sure you're aware of everything that's going on in Washington with another round of CARES Act being proposed. Can this decision be used to advocate against onerous federal legislation that's now being trying to be inserted in the next version of the CARES Act, of a debt collection moratorium or other types of regulation?
Yeah, I think similarly, it does have a good, it is helpful in order to help frame the arguments to advocate against the federal legislation. In particular, because this argument, because the decision comes out of the First Amendment and it really emphasizes the importance of having communication with debtors, I think that aligns nicely with the sort of, efforts on the federal level to say, look, you can't shut down communication here. You can't basically penalize or restrict speech in order to get at some additional sort of other policy goals. And I think that decision is pretty helpful on that, and the language around the First Amendment context of it is very helpful. The court did distinguish between moratoriums imposed under the previous CARES Act for collection of debt that's underwritten by the federal government. So I do think there's some suggestion that federally backed debt, for example, is going to be treated differently, in large part because the government might arrange for, might change the substantive rules for collection, and then they would argue incidentally restrict communications around it. So I think that is a separate sort of category of things to look at. And then, as with state laws, I think there's, there are ways in which Congress could try to get clever with their laws. I haven't seen, right now they've been talking about some pretty broad brush restrictions, which seem to raise more issues because they're so broad. And everything's moving very quickly. But I think that, the more that they have the opportunity to craft things and try to design them in a way to avoid something like a First Amendment lawsuit, that they might be able to do that. But I do think from an advocacy perspective, it's great that this case turned out this way. It does have these policy justifications underlying the legal justifications that I think would be helpful in pushing back on the federal level as well. And it's not just a you'll get sued. I think it's also a, look, these are important values that we have. We're in the middle of a pandemic, but you can't, restrict speech as a way of trying to deal with a lot of complex problems.
Yeah, and Dwayne, if I can just add one point on the First Amendment issue in terms of how broad the prohibition was and how severe it was. The regulation prohibited any debt collector from initiating, filing, or threatening to file any collection suits. So it wasn't just, going to the courthouse and filing that suit, but it was also the communication about the threatening to file and that communication about trying to resolve the case prior to litigation. So it really was a broad spectrum of communication surrounding ultimately filing suit. So this was quite a broad restriction.
So finally, so we went through the, how we got here and how it's going to affect current proposals, both on the federal level and state level. So I kind of have a question to see if you feel there's any sort of connection between this case and a situation that is of importance to NCBA. As you may know, and we've discussed, The CFPB is putting, you know, has proposed rules that are being considered. And one part of it is a safe harbor provision for meaningful attorney involvement. So do you think that this case in any way kind of carries over into that from a legal perspective, constitutional issues? Do you think there's any correlation between this case and a proposed rule that would try to seek to regulate attorneys' actions?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I think a really critical issue. I would say there's a few lessons that can be drawn from this. The first is that courts are still remaining receptive to compelling legal arguments, even in these difficult times. So, if the CFPB comes out with that rule looking like the way they proposed it, I do think that the fact that there's this ongoing issue with the pandemic shouldn't be an overlay on top of the legal issues. Courts, I think this also shows that courts will look closely at the logic of the new regulations here. It was a First Amendment claim. I think that when you're talking about meaningful attorney involvement, there's a lot of different issues there around the attorney's practice of law. And the CFPB is going to have to come up with a pretty solid evidence or justification for adopting this rule. And so when it comes out, there'll be a need to sort of look at whatever evidence it has and really, challenge that and parse through it and see if it's done its work, certainly far beyond what is put out there already. It is somewhat trickier. The standards review would be different. The CFPB is generally going to be given more deference in terms of its logic for coming up with its own rules than Massachusetts was in this case because it was a direct First Amendment challenge. But at the same time, it still has to, it does bear that burden of going through it. And then I also think that even though a challenge to something like that or trying to deal with the CFPB's meaningful attorney involvement rule wouldn't involve a necessarily direct First Amendment claim, and it's more a matter of administrative procedure, it's, there are still solid, free speech, First Amendment interests here. It can be framed against the backdrop of government interference in the way attorneys represent, communicate with their clients in collection suits. It's clear, there's also an overlay of, federalism concerns and, the ability of courts to basically regulate attorney conduct and not have the CFPB do it. But that's also, I think, an important component of it. So I would say even if it's not directly on point, there's a lot of through lines there, and I think things to look out for depending on what the CFPB does.
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you, Moshe and Duane, for covering a pretty extensive amount of information in a relatively short period of time. So we really appreciate you taking a break from your billable hours and giving us some insight in what's going on with this case. And I think this is critically important for our members, especially now with everything that's going on in Washington. So, thank you so much for doing this for us today. A recording of this briefing call will be made available to NCBA members via an announcement email later today and on creditorsbar.org. Please join us on Thursday, May 14th at 2 p.m. Eastern for the next NCBA briefing call titled An Inside Look, The CARES Act, A Need for Certainty in Uncertain Times. This is an update provided by Ryan Blake and David Pomeran from the Consumer Bankers Association. Please visit creditorsbar.org for additional resources and information regarding COVID-19 and legislation that affects our practice area and businesses. And one more time, Duane and Moshe, thank you again for joining us. It was a pleasure to hear from you, and we look forward to hearing from both of you in the future about other cases and other critically important information. So to our members who are listening, I'll give you back the rest of your day. Stay healthy, stay safe, and we look to see you on our next briefing call. Thank you.